We come on to the second noble truth, getting burned. And this is the illustration here, I think, is can safely be said to represent Ajahn Sucitto at his most demonic, with the blazing fires of the circle of dependent origination, a couple of bug-eyed dragons, and a very demented and gap-toothed cross-eyed monkey at the bottom. So I think he was really trying to evoke the whole sort of derangement of craving in the representation. So chapter 6, second noble truth, getting burned. So the Pali reads, Idan ko pannabhikkhave dukkha samudayo ariyasacchaṃ yāyaṃ taṇhā pono bhavikā nandirāga sahagatā tatra tatra binandini seyāditaṃ kāma taṇhā bhava taṇhā vibhava taṇhā. He begins with one of his great phrases, a true classic. Circles can be peaceful, but they can also be vicious when they represent, as these do, the regenerative aspect of the suffering that they describe. So it's one of my favorite Ajahn Sucitto phrases. Circles can be peaceful, but they can also be vicious. In the last frame, the man holds onto his chains. That's like the picture from the previous section. The man holds onto his chains, which are symbolic of the world of the five aggregates, with this figure burdened, buried under the weight of the chains formed in the shape of a large, a massive sack that the fellow's carrying. The more he feels burdened by it, the harder he holds on, imagining all the while that by this effort he's preventing himself from being overwhelmed. So the heavier it is, the harder you hang on to it. Imagining all the while that by this effort he is preventing himself from being overwhelmed. The circle in this picture is fire, and its repetitive cycle is caused by the three forms of desire rooted in self, tanha. These three desires chase each other around in circles and are preoccupied with trying to eliminate each other. This is represented by the three violent creatures emanating from the central fire. Yes. The monkey at the bottom symbolizes the untrained mind, in that it always darts hither and thither, and the hand at the top, as in the last painting, is the hand of the Buddha held in the symbolic teaching gesture, the mudra. The little vignettes in the loops of fire I'll explain later. So all around the edges, what was just the burning chains in the first picture have sort of turned into these loops of fire, and within the loops you have these different figures around the edges there that represent the different aspects of dependent origination, which he will get to. If you felt dismayed by the first noble truth, but were determined to get to the heart of the matter, as was the case with those five bhikkhus, you're probably ready to go through the fire of the second noble truth, which is about the origin of suffering and, by inference, of grasping. The Buddha points out, Idan ko pannabhikkhave, so then he repeats this passage that is the theme of this section, the translation of which is, Bhikkhus, there is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is desire which gives rise to fresh birth, bound up with relish and passion, running here and there, delighting in this and in that. In other words, sense desire, desire for existing, and desire for extinction. So yāyaṃ taṇhā, taṇhā is the word for desire or craving. Pono bhavikā means giving rise to fresh birth. So the word for rebirth is pono or pono bhava, which literally means again becoming, pono bhava. bound up with relish and passion, which is nandiraga sahagata. Nandi is delight. Raga is passion, as in the English word rage. Passion, the Pali word raga is related to that, passion. Running here and there. Nandi raga sahagata tatra tatra binandini. Which Morris Walsh also translates very neatly as ever seeking fresh delight. Tatra tatra means here and there. Ever seeking fresh delight. Delighting in this and that. In other words, sense desire, desire for existing, and desire for extinction. So karma tanha, that's, and also it's important to distinguish between the word karma, K long A M A, which means sense pleasure, and then kamma, which is K double M A, which means action, or the Sanskrit for that is karma. So the two words are quite different. So karma tanha is the one for sense desire. So if you, it's not just a karma as in action that's being talked about here. So first of all, I'm going to say something about tanha, generally translated as desire. These translations are difficult because the words don't exactly correspond to the same meaning in the two languages. Dukkha is almost impossible to catch in a single word. Khanda doesn't mean much as an aggregate, and tanha as desire gives rise to some misinterpretations. What about the desire to realize truth? Is that suffering? Actually, tanha means thirst, and as the context explains, is purely the kind of desire that wants something for me. At another time, the Buddha defined tanha simply as desire for sights, sounds, for fragrance, for tastes, for things to touch, and for ideas. Tanha, then, is the desire that pulls things inwards, not the desire that radiates out, like aspiration or compassion. These are all aspects of spiritual truth. It is a truth that cannot be grasped selfishly. In fact, you could summarize spiritual training as the transformation of selfish desire into selfless desire, zest and aspiration. And that second kind of desire is called chanda, or particularly Dhamma chanda, C-H-A-N-D-A. And as he points out, a huge amount of spiritual training revolves around transforming the habits and this, or the energy of a tanha, self-centered craving, to the chanda, which the interest or zeal, the enthusiasm or zest, as he has here, for liberation and for the benefiting of others. So chanda is also desire. And so when people say, well, the Buddha says desire is the root of all suffering, it's important to distinguish that there are skillful desires and unskillful desires. So the word tanha always represents that which is unskillful. It's invariably bound up with the feelings of self and self-benefit in some way, shape, or form. So you can't really you can't have tanha for enlightenment. You can't have tanha to have compassion in a genuine way. That kind of desire would not be tanha. It's sort of an opposite of that. Whereas chanda is a necessary aspect. That desire to be awakened, that desire to be enlightened, that desire to help others is a prerequisite condition. It's a necessity in terms of fulfilling those potentials. So, to carry on. The desire that acts as a motivation to know how things really are, beyond the grasp of the gratification instinct, is the needed vigor to carry one through the rough patches. So it's important that in abandoning the fantasized and deluded objects of desire, one doesn't sink into an apathetic fatalism, or into believing that the putting forth of energy in spiritual practice is another form of craving, which is a common misunderstanding that people think, the Buddha said all kinds of desire, you know, desire is the cause of suffering, therefore I should just turn myself into a potato, or something of that nature, just go numb or stop feeling or switch off, and I'm being desireless. But that's this is called wrong view, wrong understanding, and that's because it's not what is meant by the ending of desires. And when you tease those two kinds of desire apart, so you distinguish tanha from chanda, then that makes a lot more sense. As he says, the The putting forth of energy into spiritual practice is another form of craving. That would be a wrong view. Then consider the following reflection. Isn't the desire to extinguish desire an aspect of the desire for extinction? Sometimes you wish you didn't have any desires, and you feel really, really depressed by the inability to get rid of them. That's suffering, isn't it? When it comes down to it, a lot of the gratification instinct is about getting rid of itchy, hankering feelings. The First Noble Truth seems to say that life is suffering, but more accurately, it states that there is a range of feelings that we have to bear with through the experience of birth, aging, and death. This is experienced as suffering as long as the way things appear to us is taken as an absolute truth. The heart of the matter is that life is not a flawed experience. Rather, it is made that way by an unconscious activity of the mind. We don't realize that we're doing it. We're simply not aware at the level of the mind that the activity is born. These two truths, and a good deal of Buddhist mind training, help to focus our attention deeper in our heart so that we can stop the seeds of suffering from being planted. Suffering arises. It has an origin. We can recognize that the feeling of emotional dissatisfaction begins. We were feeling pretty good, and then we got offended, or the good time came to an end. In a little while, we feel upset, or we hanker after some new way of enjoying ourselves. The fact that the arising of suffering can be noticed means that it arises from something other than suffering, and that there is something other than suffering that notices it. Whatever arises as a cause is created. Simply to recognize that suffering arises is the beginning of opening the mind to a deeper understanding. So also those two points is good to highlight there. Firstly, that if suffering arises, then there must have been a state of non-suffering before. And when the suffering ends, what's present needs to be appreciated as well. And also, that which knows suffering isn't suffering. And this is, in a way, a key aspect of the development of wisdom, is that that which knows agitation is not agitated. That which knows being, and that which knows the feeling of being offended is not offended. That which knows the feeling of anger is not angry. It's knowing the feeling, but it's not identified with that feeling. The quality of awareness is intrinsically separate from the objects of awareness. And so that is a central feature for the whole process of liberation. If we neither contemplate suffering nor wish to understand it, suffering is not so noticeable. Instead of looking at it, we keep shifting away from it to absorb into something else. This is the birth habit I mentioned earlier. But what that causes is an underlying sense of dis-ease, denial, and even cynicism in the psyche, the get-it-while-you-can syndrome. A natural state of joy or contentment is considered impossible, and happiness arises only when we have our security, our creature comforts, our best friends. Then we say, I don't suffer, life is great. At such times, which we assume to be the norm, we easily forget our frequent disappointments and irritations, or try to ease the chafing of life with some balm of comfort or bluff heartiness. Ha 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 ha, I'm fine, I'm fine. In the States, they talk about FINE as being an acronym for fed up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. I'm fine. Oh, yes. Also, we unconsciously assume that calamities won't occur, that our partner won't get run down by a truck, or that our child won't be crippled by a disease. Most incredible of all, something in us is shocked by death. We still feel that sickness, death, betrayals, breakdowns, and failures are an outrageous deviation from the smooth flow of life. This is what the Buddha called unknowing, or avijja, the mind's contraction to a level where the full range of birth's potential is not accepted. Although this avijja is a buffer that the psyche uses to protect itself from suffering, it actually drives the dukkha deeper into our hearts, affecting our ability to be open and easeful with life. So this is a very helpful way of expressing what our minds do, and that we feel like, I'm fine, I don't suffer. But what that means is I've got a really efficient system of avoiding dukkha, so that I can always change. I've got a really good set of things, reliable system of stimulation and distraction stacked up, so I can stay feeling at that the endorphin level is kind of flowing. my preferred rate, and I've got enough things when I'm not feeling when I'm feeling hungry. I've got the supply of food in the fridge, or when I'm full, I've got a place to have a nap. When I want to go out for a walk, I've got some nice all-weather walking gear. Yeah, I've got a dog to take out. And when I get back, then I've got a nice warm home to come back to. And we think, I'm fine. Life is great. I don't suffer. What's the problem? What are they talking about? But if we think it through, and if we made a little table of all the things that we depend on during the course of a day, it can be quite revealing as how much stuff we depend on. Many years ago, I was at a conference with a meeting of Buddhist Western Buddhist teachers with the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala, and it was quite revealing how we went. It was, I think it was in March, and the weather was damp and rainy and cold. And we got checked into our hotel, and someone said, I can't seem to get any heat in my room. And of course, the guy behind the desk says, I'm terribly sorry, madam. the electricity's out. This is Dharamsala, McLeod Ganj. The power supply is not reliable. And she said, well, but you don't understand. Like my things are damp from the rain. I need to dry my things. I'm sorry, madam. You can hang them up and But no, I need to dry my things. And this person who's a very well-known, prominent Buddhist teacher, and well-regarded as an expert in meditation, she completely—well, I wouldn't say completely fell apart. That's an exaggeration. But she was severely distressed that she couldn't get her things dry, and that her room was not warm and was not warmable. That it was just, no, that there isn't a possibility of making this room warm at the moment. If you want to be warm, you have to go somewhere else, because this can't happen here. In your clothes, you're not going to get your clothes dried here. And just the sense of it was quite startling to me how just what you would think of as a tiny thing like that completely threw this person off balance. Like, had never in her whole life been in a situation where she couldn't be warm and dry, or couldn't have her things sort of comfortable clothes to put on, but it was just, no, it's cold and wet, and it's cold and wet. No, and there's nothing else you can do. So not to blame her, but it was really striking how someone who has been teaching and practicing meditation for years and decades and decades, one little thing changes, one thing is not available, and suddenly they're thrown totally off balance. And she was really very distressed, right through until they managed to get the power on and work things out a bit. But still, it was. I think we can all translate that into our own worlds, where something goes out of whack. We have an injury, or somebody lets us down, or something happens that makes our usual supply of distractions and comforts and reassurances not available. And then we discover, oh, what's my refuge? And we are, introduced to the things that we're dependent on at those kind of times. And as he points out, that as he says, most incredible of all, something in us is shocked by death. We still feel that sickness, death, betrayals, and breakdowns of failures are an outrageous deviation from the smooth flow of life. So this is such a common theme. I mean, so many people come to visit here when their family members have died. Loved ones and parents and children and very grief stricken. I was talking about this the other day, and so I'll often say, well, the Buddha encourages us to wake up to this, because I say, and I'll do it right now, everybody in this room is going to die one day. There's not a single person here who is going to be alive in 100 years' time, 150 years' time. Am I right? All these bodies are going to stop breathing within 100 years or so. Even the longest lived and the youngest of us, will, even though we've got life extension programs, at least a couple of 100 years, where all these bodies will have stopped breathing. That's not news, right? But when I say everyone here is going to die one day, something in us goes, no, 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 no. Right? There's some mistake. Right? Isn't it crazy? It's absolutely crazy. But something in us says, no, no, that's not right. But you, it takes you 3 seconds to work through the logic, and yeah. But we have this forgettery. Well, this is the opposite of the memory. This forgettery that filters those things out. I said, no, it won't happen to me. It won't happen now. It won't happen. It's over there somewhere. And that's I think a very good expression. It's these kind of sickness and death. These are an outrageous deviation from the smooth flow of life. And we have this strange perception that we have the right to expect comfort, friendship, security, and a good food supply with Jose in the kitchen. It's kind of very reliable. But we have this delusion that Jose is going to be there forever. We hope he'll be for at least a couple of decades, but. And in our own homes, in our own lives, we have this forgettery keeps filtering out these actualities of life. So this is why the Buddha encourages the five subjects for frequent recollection. I am of the nature to age, I am of the nature to sicken, I am of the nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. Now, the Buddha was not a sadist. He was not trying to just make fun of people or make us feel bad or depressed. But he's just Ajahn Sajito's pointing out here. It's like, wake up! this is the program that you're in the middle of, that you are a part of. That this is, it's not a weird deviation that you get sick, or that you've tweaked your back, or that your partner's walked out on you. That's not anything going wrong. That's just how life is. It's not dependable. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise. You think, well, the Buddha was just, he was just working on guesswork there. I mean, he was just, he couldn't have known that was really the case. But understanding nature, and seeing how things work, the Buddha saw all that has come together has to separate. That's a law of nature. Therefore, everything that is beloved and pleasing has to depart, has to end somehow. It's the mathematics of nature. If it's come together, it has to separate. That's how things are. So he wasn't making particular predictions about our own personal lives. It's just, this is how it is for all people in all times. So, to bring those things to mind is not just to make ourselves depressed, but rather to develop a realism. Oh, right, of course. So that then we are able to look at that within us that pushes it away, to recognize that filtering and all that which makes us dependent and fearful that something's going to go wrong. I'm going to lose that which is precious. Oh, no, I don't, I can't, I don't. Oh. And the Buddha's teaching helps us to turn towards that and say, what's there to be afraid of? This has always been the case. There's nothing to be afraid of. But that has to be seen by us as individuals. We have to turn and look ourselves, because it's not just a matter of having a reassuring words from a teacher outside. The Buddha saying, don't worry, there's nothing to fear. It's like we have to turn our hearts to that ourselves, to look and see what our dependencies are. Then seeing them, then they can be let go of. If we don't see them, then they can't be let go of. So, to continue. For example, what happens when we try to recover from suffering? We often find something else to distract our minds, or perhaps we repress the pain. During a lifetime of many small disappointments, betrayals, threats, and the rest, We develop a tough skin over our sensitivity and a feeling that happiness is something that we have to seek out. Eventually, there is so much hide protecting the heart that the innate joy of being alive becomes inaccessible. Many layers of stiff upper lip. It gets leathery over time. Many people would not even guess that happiness is an innate state of being, independent of circumstances. The Buddha found that happiness in the purity of his heart and called that innate purity of being the unconditioned. It is unconditioned because it is not dependent on conditions, and one who realizes that experiences nibbana, the highest happiness. So that's a very beautiful way of expressing that the realization of the unconditioned is that recognition, the realization, or the direct awakening to the heart's own nature. So as he says, the Buddha found that happiness in the purity of his heart and called that innate purity of being the unconditioned. But for the average person, happiness is dependent on circumstances. They don't see suffering because they've created the circumstances to avoid it. But the avoidance of suffering is not the cessation of suffering. Suffering remains a distinct possibility, and we take every step to prevent it. We tend to settle for guarded security. However, that too is suffering. The defensiveness and anxiety that someone might rob us or attack us, or that some insidious virus might be gnawing its way through our immune system. The average comfortable Westerner living with material adequacy is still always prone to anxiety. The possibility of losing one's partner, one's job, one's health, one's standing in the community, one's dignity or sense of well-being. When our happiness is dependent on a fragile tissue of circumstance, no one can afford to relax and be at ease. Societies where people have a lot of opportunities and possibilities for pleasure are generally frantic, anxious, or neurotic. And people who depend on fortunate conditions for their happiness become quite selfish and deluded, refusing to accept that there might have to be some constraint on how they use the planet, their bodies, or other people. The right to pursue one's own happiness easily gets distorted into the right to do whatever turns you on, no matter what the effects might be on others. The right to use as much of the earth's resources as one likes, to have whatever one wants immediately, and live a life of ever-renewing pleasure and vitality. Just as for an alcoholic, the gratification of desire only leads to more and more thirst, not to its quenching. That's the circle of fire, and it often begins with a pleasant, warm glow. So it's also interesting that often the most comfortable and secure societies are the ones where there's the greatest experience of depression, alcoholism, and suicide. So that the this mysterious way, the safer the society, often places that are incredibly stable, like Scandinavian countries or New Zealand and such, kind of benign and safe societies in many respects, the level of depression is enormous, and often in countries where life is much more on the edge, where people are struggling to survive and find the necessities of life, you haven't got time to be depressed because you got to find water to the family. You've got to get some shelter and protect yourself from the kind of vicious elements that you're living with. So that it's a very pertinent point that he makes there. By our inability to relate and respond wisely to the downside of life, or even to accept that it might exist, we've taken dukkha deep into ourselves and buried it there, where it's difficult to extract. From not living in accordance with the changing rhythm of life, from experiencing it always to be bright and positive, from expecting it to be always bright and positive, we create a specter that haunts the heart and affects the ways we view and live our lives. We make dukkha an ultimate truth that we run away from for as long as we can by absorbing ourselves into the upside of the sensory world. But we can't commit ourselves for too long to any one thing because, like the waves of the sea, the sensory world has its downside. And remember, the sensory world is a lot more than beer and parties. Now we have all kinds of refined things to watch or taste, and the mind especially offers a vast potential for sensory enjoyment. There are so many things one can study. that this is hardly considered a sensory activity. But in the Buddhist analysis, it is. We delight in intriguing ideas or in being aroused by tales of stirring adventure. Then again, one can alter one's consciousness completely with drugs. So the sensory world allows us to get absorbed into many states, into each of which we are propelled by karma or volition, and each is experienced as the arising of the five khandhas. They are births. We experience being born into the sensory realm. And since we do it over and over again, no birth satisfies us for very long. Also, I'm reminded of a story about speaking about the suffering of ownership and possession. As you said, the anxiety that someone might rob us the anxiety that someone might rob us or attack us, and that the how ownership of things might bring dukkha with it. Many years ago, when I was living here in the 80s. A young Thai women came, and it was in the days when this used to be a car park, where the cloister is now. It used to be where the cars parked outside the front of the sala, and it was after the meal time, and Lumpur Sumedho had gone, so I was receiving guests, this bright red Mercedes pulled up outside, just outside the window, and these two young women came in, and so we were talking together, and they hadn't visited Amaravati before, and they were asking about the teachings and about meditation and so on, and we got onto this subject about desire and dukkha and how they were related, and so I said, and in Thailand it's probably not the same now, but in those days owning a Mercedes was the sort of lay equivalent of arahantship. It's like the ultimate happiness. Kind of the,
It still is.
It's an absolute status symbol more than anything else. So to own a Mercedes, and so so I said. So say for example, this here you are. You've come to England. You've been studying. You've gone to work. You've earned some money. You've managed to buy yourselves a nice cherry red Mercedes, and you can take pictures of yourself by the car and say, "Hi, Mom, Dad, here we are, we made it, ta-da!" And you feel very happy, and they're saying, yeah, that's right, yeah, absolutely, yeah. They didn't actually take out the pictures, that was before the era of iPhones. But they said, yeah, that's right, that's exactly what we were doing. I said, so then your Mercedes is a source of great happiness, right? So they think, wow, this is great, and we've made it, new country, new life, success, happy. Red Mercedes. So then I said, say, for example, you park your car out on the street, and then some rowdies come out of a pub, and they see this Mercedes parked on the street, and they get out their keys, and they make a big, long scratch all the way down the side. And so then you come out, and you see your beautiful Mercedes with this big scratch. Somebody's keyed your car, and then you're suddenly that that delight of ownership and your happiness of owning the car then becomes a source of great suffering. Like, how can they do that? They ruined the car, and getting all upset. As I'm speaking in these terms, then one of the women starts to look a little embarrassed, and the other one starts giggling. And as I'm carrying on, or waxing lyrically on this theme, the one who starts giggling breaks out into kind of full-blown, kind of uncontrollable laughter, and actually fell over. She was laughing so much, which is very unusual for Thai people with a monk. They're usually far more restrained. But she was laughing so much, she literally fell over on the floor. And so this obviously brought the conversation to a bit of a pause. And she sort of sat up and she said, "You should have heard her in the car on the way up here, because that's just what happened last night." She said, she was swearing her head off at these people who had ruined the car. And I was saying to her, you shouldn't be saying that stuff. We're on the way to the monastery. It's all kinds of bad karma you're creating. But she was just so angry and so upset about their car being ruined that she was turning the air blue on the way. And I'd said, look, I was not being psychic, just using that as a random example. But it was a very clear case in point how that which is a source of great delight, and then you think, wow, I've got this wonderful thing. Then you got to keep it. You got to protect it. And Lumpu Cha used to tell the story of how when he went to visit the Sangharaja of Thailand one time, and the Sangharaja was telling him how when he made an official visit to China, they'd given him this antique porcelain teacup. It was very, very old and very delicate and very precious. And he said as soon as they gave it to him, he started worrying about it. And that whenever they were packing and going from the reception back to the hotel and packing their things, he was kept wanting to check to see that his attendant had packed it all right, or was it being looked after, or was it not going to get bashed by anything. And all the way back on the plane, he was worrying about his teacup. And he said, finally, about a month or two after he got back, finally his attendant knocked it over and broke it. And he said, "Ah, thank goodness. Now I can stop worrying." Last is broken. Yeah. Okay, so we try to become something in order to feel that we are making progress. This is another kind of thirst. It is the desire for existing or becoming, quote unquote, as it is also translated. This means the desire for some position in the temporal or spatial world that consciousness projects. We feel ourselves to be immaterial things regarding experience, affected by it, even imperiled by it. And we seek to become in control of or able to understand and direct the life experience. Becoming is very powerful. We do things now so that we can be in a better situation in the future. We study in order to qualify for a good job, to have a stable family life, or to have love and security and an adequate supply of sensory happiness. This is reasonable enough, but it often entails overriding the experience of the present. People work themselves hard and become very stressed, chasing the dream of ease in the future, and the amount of stress that one undergoes in order to achieve one's goals makes it necessary to raise the expectations of what the future will provide. Certainly people do lie and cheat to get ahead, and after years of cheating and manipulating others, may feel disappointed that life doesn't live up to their expectations. How can it? There are the laws of cause and effect, karma vipaka, at work, and they operate according to the state of your intentions and actions. The way you act in the present determines how you're going to feel and the kind of situations you'll tend to find yourself with in the future. If you are an aggressive, unscrupulous go-getter, you'll associate with the kind of people who fit into that way of operating. Naturally enough, such companionship will reinforce the drive to get something in the future, and the stress. The aggressiveness comes back to your own mind and body, until you find yourself born into an untrustworthy circle of associates, an ulcer or a coronary. That's how becoming leads to birth. The process of becoming operates on a subtler level than big business competitiveness, or desire for fame. The inner self, quote-unquote, that is, the experience of becoming, projects values and wishes onto everything. Notice when doing a mundane chore that the attitude is frequently one of wanting to get it done, wanting to have it finished in order to be peaceful, to relax, or to enjoy oneself. That too is dukkha. Rushing along to get to the next moment, we fail to open and appreciate this moment. The laws of karma are that if you operate in that way in this moment, the same momentum takes you through the next moment, colouring your awareness of the present with its moods and perceptions. You want to go to a show, so you hastily take a shower, change your clothes, abruptly cut off a friend who's just phoned, leap in the car, find out that you left the keys in your other jacket, rush back to the house, trip over the dog in the hallway. The scenario proceeds to the traffic jam, the lost temper, the minor accident, and then finding out that the show's been cancelled anyway. Which is what your friend was phoning you up to tell you. This is Ajahn Sujito with his full Ebenezer Scrooge mode. Bah, humbug. Just notice, a mind filled with desire does not appreciate anything. And most people hardly investigate the quality of the present moment because, as a sensory experience, it may be nothing special. However, to one who cultivates attention to the present, whatever form the present moment takes, the mind begins to reveal its treasures, sensitivity, joy, confidence, and serenity. When we get tired of running around in sensory stimulation, then the third kind of desire operates, the desire for extinction. So that previous kind of desire for becoming, is called bhava tanha. The desire for extinction. These terms are not to be taken as absolutes. They apply to mind movements that may be momentary only or vaguely perceived. Vibhava tanha is the desire to get rid of. To get rid of something or to get out of it all. This is often a repressive influence or simply an attitude of not wanting to be bothered. I don't want to see this. It's also a force in us that denies our pain and sorrow, or makes us want to annihilate ourselves in sleep, drugs, or with suicide. It often results from the other two forms of desire. If they are followed blindly, they leave us in states of mind that we dislike, and therefore avoid being aware of. So, we try to annihilate that awareness, even if it means destroying ourselves. What people don't realize is that vibhava tanha leads to birth too. Birth in a negative state of repression or self-denial in this world or in another life. These three motivating influences of desire continue to operate on subtler levels of activity too. Even with a spiritual inclination, the mind can be motivated by the desire to get out of it all, vibhava tanha. The desire for spiritual attainment can be a form of bhava tanha, desire to become, when it is to enhance one's self-image, even just in one's own eyes. This can actually hinder and bar progress towards purification of the mind by making one unwilling to fully understand the various unenlightened habits that one has to work through. So those of you who've spent much time listening to Lumpur Zomato's teachings will know these bhava tanha, vibhava tanha are extremely common themes, and which also I tend to dwell upon, because these are, you can think of as a sort of meditator's disease, is the desire to get jhana, desire to become enlightened, or desire to get rid of my defilements, get rid of my chattering thoughts. And as Lumpur Zomato will point out over and over again, so easily our noble intentions in spiritual practice get co-opted by bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. So then just to finish this section, sense desire, karma tanha, in terms of spiritual aims, is the desire for refined and blissful states of mind to absorb into. Sit padded up with an elaborate system of cushions, so that you won't have to be aware of bodily feeling, in a retreat center where nobody bothers you, and there's no untoward sensory impingement. Then, use a meditation technique that gets you into a state of absorption and cruise on refined mind states for a while. This doesn't always work for Westerners who have such overstimulated minds that to get them to quieten down through withdrawal often requires such manipulation and stressful effort that it is self-defeating. Being thwarted in this way, they then have the chance to develop insight into the Four Noble Truths by investigating suffering and realizing the wisdom that goes beyond desire. The mind moves extremely fast, and desire creates so much movement that it's difficult to see what is really going on. Sometimes desires augment each other. You want to become something so that you will have more happiness on the sensory plane. You want to get rid of your habits so that you'll become a more productive human being. You would like to have a really comfortable meditation cushion so that you can become a wiser, more compassionate being. Sometimes they fight with each other. I want to get rid of my disgusting sensual appetites, or maybe I should get into beer and TV to get rid of my attachment to purity and show that I'm not obsessed with becoming enlightened. And so on. I want. This is the way it is. Such is the promotion of suffering. Notice that the Buddha makes no moral judgment here. He does not tell you not to be this way or to cut it out. In fact, he doesn't say that you are that way. He just says that there are these energies at work. Remember, the First Noble Truth points to the suffering which arises from grasping existence in terms of self. As soon as you start saying you are this way and you should be another way, self-desire has slipped into the mind. So the language of the Buddha's teachings is deliberately impersonal. This way, we don't get ashamed or defensive and have the encouragement to investigate the way things are in a more open and objective light. So just then to go back to that, this the framework for this whole process, what I like to emphasize is how as long as our spiritual efforts are wound up with self-view, like me trying to to get somewhere, me trying to get concentrated, me trying to get rid of my distracted thoughts, me trying to get rid of my unsavory desires and aversions, that as long as that self-view is in the picture, then you can be sure. That's the clear sign, that's the flag that says bhavatanna vibhavatanna. And even though we might put a lot of effort in with great noble intentions, as long as it's based on that, on self-view, then the result is going to be dukkha. And as Lumpur Samedho put it, if you start off with ignorance, you end up with dukkha. If you start out with self-view, the result has to be unsatisfactoriness. But if instead that we are aware of that process, we're aware that how easy it is to slip into bhavatanna vibhavatanna, if there's an alertness to that, then as that is recognized, oh, this me trying to get that state, that's what's happening here, the mind is framing it up. I want that beautiful state, that's what I want, because it's a good state. That to say, ah, that's me wanting to become other, me who's creating a me here, who wants to get hold of that, so it'll be a me with that good thing. Aha. And to be able to see that framework being created, that conceiving, it's called manyati, the conceiving, or making the making of the I feeling, when that's seen through wisdom, then it can be let go of. And so then what's necessary for those wholesome states to arise can be cultivated, but without the sense of I want to get, or I haven't got, and I need to be that way in order to be happy. So that right effort, or samavayamo, that effort is being expended, where there's effort being made, but it's based upon mindfulness and wisdom, it's not based upon self-view. So it's in a way going back to the distinction between chanda, a sort of spiritual, and say dhamma chanda, that spiritual enthusiasm, or the interest, zeal, or zest, that's the necessary primary condition. That is completely different from tanha, where we're craving to get something that we want. So that as the way that the Lumpur Samedho would frame it, with, if you start off with vijja, if you start off with wisdom, then the result is nibbana. The result is realization, is freedom. If you start off with avijja, then the result is dukkha. So that's a really easy way to kind of package it. Start off with avijja, end up with dukkha. Start off with vijja, you end up with nibbana. So I think that's enough from me. So any particular questions or clarifications people would like, please. As usual, don't be shy.
I would like to say something, but I don't know, or ask something. I don't know quite how to phrase it. Recently I recognized that I take some delight in really acknowledging what is happening and not trying to be better than, trying to cover it over with, always trying to improve, trying to. So I got so, fed up with the tension of trying to improve that I started to sit back and just look, what kind of therapy was actually happening right now, and feel the pain of it, by the way.
The pain of?
The self-view and expectation or whatever is kind of hidden, there. And to my surprise, I feel really comfortable with that.
That shouldn't be a surprise.
Something so familiar, yeah. It's really to actually, comfortable is not the right word, it's more the acknowledging of it feels as if it's the healing is starting with that. So I don't want to get the wrong phrase, because that would miss the point. But really it's really painful. If I sit kept in meditation, and something has happened, you know, in my mind, and I should meditate here.
Yeah, that's very good.
And what is the feeling here? The heart, you know?
You know, well, Lumpur Sumedha said he used to, and I really took this to heart. He said that when he get in his early years at Wat Pa Phong, he gets so wrapped up in trying to be the perfect monk, and trying to get his practice together, and trying to develop samadhi. He just every so often he would just forbid himself to meditate. He'd just sit on the veranda of his kuti and look at the squirrels, and he did it deliberately to listen to that voice in his mind saying, but Sumedho, you should be meditating. You shouldn't just be sitting here watching the squirrels, you know. You should meditate, Sumedho, you know. Just to hear that nagging voice saying, you know, you should. And he had enough wisdom to be able to, oh, that's really important to know, and not just to be subjugated by that and dominated by that voice. Because it's like addressing ourselves in that way. To some degree, it's like going up to a tree and saying, "You need to improve yourself. Like, you're not doing very well. You know, as an oak tree, you know, you could do better." Well, you're totally at liberty to go and talk to a tree like that. But, you know, one can take that to an extreme, and then it turns into being a kind of passivity where there's useful and appropriate things that could be done and not being done, because you've sort of grasped the idea of not, I'm practicing not doing. And so in a way you're then freezing the natural responsivity, but the point is to learn to listen to that compulsive you should, and to just let the system relax in its wakefulness.
I mean, what I can hear is that the fruit of it is that with this relaxing, it just as if things are moving a little bit away from you, and there's more the resting and the knowing happening, because there's less identification with what is happening and trying to change it. That is really the part which is comfortable, and becomes a comfortable is maybe also not the right word, but it's without suffering, you know, and a kind of refuge.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I find it just interesting that in a way I know all of this. I've been trying to get there.
Yeah, the mind creates obstacles. Yeah.
It may work for a little bit, and then you lose it again, and so it goes back and forth. But this kind of watching the squirrels, you know. Anyway, so I for me that fits very well with this chapter. Mm. You know. With always trying to avoid the notion of the suffering.
Yeah, that urge to do something with it, and not realizing that the me who's got to do something with it is continuing to create it. But it also makes you appreciate why the Buddha had this feeling. There's no point trying to explain this to anybody. That it's too subtle, because there's this need for acute attention, but without a sense of doing that, that me trying to become something, and that blend of qualities of yes, something needs to be done, but if there's somebody there trying to do it, then it's always going to be getting in the way. That's the first fetter, the first obstacle, the first thing tying the mind down is me trying to do something to get somewhere. So it's a, you know, it's a subtle process, but you know, these teachings are so helpful in that respect, because also it relates a bit to the third noble truth, which, you know, we'll get onto. Is we've got a whole chunk of dependent origination, yeah. But in the third noble truth, when the method of working with the third truth, dukkha nirodha, is sacchikata bhanti, it needs to be realized. It's to be realized, to be awakened to. So, in a way, what you're describing is that sacchikata bhanti, sacchikatanti, that it's recognizing, oh, this is when the mind stops that self-creating. Ah, well, this is different. That direct realizing of the mind free of dukkha, and training the attention to stay with that spaciousness and peacefulness. That's the, in a way, the development of the third noble truth is training the attention to stay with the absence of dukkha, to stay with spaciousness and clarity, and not to follow the habit of looking for the next thing.